Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. In this week's episode, we're taking a sobering look at the experiences of migrants and asylum seekers at the southern border. Thus far, politics have stood in the way of immigration reform. But while policymakers are duking it out, international, national, and local nonprofit organizations have stepped in to provide vital, life-saving services. Joining us are Lee Gallant, he's deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project, Carolyn Miles, president and CEO of Save the Children, Maria Moreno, principal of Las Americas Newcomer School in Texas, and John Ryan, CEO and president of Raices. Moderating the program is Neil Kenny Geyer. He's CEO of Mercy Corps. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron. This program was produced in association with KQED and the Aspen Institute. And now to Neil Kenny Geyer.
As many of you will know who have come to the forum in years past, the forum has focused on the global refugee crisis. But in this case, we really want to focus on the issues, the humanitarian crisis, on the southern border of the U.S., both inside Mexico as well as within the U.S. And we're going to start first with Maria.
I run a school called Las Americas Newcomer School in Houston, ISD. We're a part of the public school system. And so I service a school where there's 32 different countries representing it, speaking 29 different languages. So as you talk about the Northern Triangle, this year we have a large influx of students coming in from our Northern Triangle, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And we are finding some students also now coming from Venezuela and Cuba. I've been the school principal there for 14 years, but my work around refugee and immigrant children has actually gone further back, working 24 years with the Houston Independent School District, working with the high school, where there's 72 countries represented there and speaking 42 different languages. So there at my school, we have grades 4 through 8. And so you're looking at young children, ages 9 through 15, that have made this journey up through Mexico, trying to find their families, crossing with sometimes their families themselves, trauma that our students have endured in coming here. Our mascot is the Rhinos because it stands for really hungry individuals in need of opportunity. And so it's a really powerful motto that we have, but it's a mascot that shows resilience and strength that our kids have when they come. So you can just imagine how I have a 9-year-old who comes in who is traumatized and reuniting with mom for the first time and sitting down and working and making sure not only are we working on the social emotional needs of our children, but also we have to look at the academics as well. The school is created back in 1998, so this is not something that just is a fly-by-night thing. We've been around, this is our 20th year, and so we're really excited to see some of the outcomes that have already come out from our kids that have gone through a program and come back and have really done some really great work in the community and also kind of passing it forward, if you will, to helping other kids that are newly arrived now and supporting those families as well.
Maria, thank you. Carolyn.
So thank you, and thanks to Maria, who's one of our partners in Houston, for coming today, too. So I wanted to talk a little bit, actually I wanted to pick up on a point that I think David Brooks hit on earlier today, and one of the things I think we need to remember as we think about this crisis here in the United States is that we need to change this narrative about the other. So much of what we talk about now is about the other, and my hope is that, you know, children are not a partisan issue. Children are not the other. Children are children. And so I really want to frame this in the needs and the rights of children. But I want to go back a little bit to the root causes of a lot of these families that are coming here to the United States. And if you look at the Northern Triangle, so Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, a couple of the things there that you see. First of all, Honduras has the highest per capita murder rate of 0 to 19-year-olds in the world. So This is not a made-up thing. This is really real that these families are escaping this really incomprehensible violence, not only poverty, but also violence, economic deprivation. There's a coffee rust that has hit this area of the world and has been going on since 2013, 2014. So there's multi-layers of this, but when you hear people say this isn't real, this is just people trying to sneak into the United States, this is really real. And I was in El Salvador not too long ago, and a young boy, 15-year-old, told me this story about how he was with his friend. They were attacked by a gang. His friend literally died in his arms. This was a 15-year-old. And he said to me, I'm not sure that I actually will ever survive to be a grown-up in my country. Mm-hmm. So I want you to keep in mind, this is real. This is why people are leaving. This is not some kind of made-up thing. And it's really important for us to remind ourselves of that. So the kinds of things that organizations like Save the Children and Mercy Corps and others do in these areas of origin are, we do youth violence prevention. We do schools of what we call schools of peace. We're trying really to get kids to be able to push away against gangs, to get families to deal with the violence that's going on there. Youth empowerment programs. We actually counsel families on the dangers of migration and the dangers of sending their children to the United States on this very difficult journey. I have to say, the recent action by our president on cutting off aid in Central America is completely baffling to me. I do not understand it. It is exactly the kinds of services that we need that will help us reduce the migration of families and putting kids into these very, very difficult circumstances. So I think there is a huge policy issue here. I definitely don't pretend to know how to solve the immigration problem, but I can tell you that cutting off aid to the Northern Triangle is not a good way to do it. I wanted to just end on one story that I think demonstrates kind of the issues that children and families are facing. So this picture is of a little girl, Angelina. And Angelina came in 2018 to the United States with her father, Diego. This is her mom. And her mom stayed behind with her younger sister. And Angelina, who was 3 at the time, was separated from her father for 6 months by herself, living in a detention center with lots of other children, right? And being cared for. When her father was deported, we didn't know, no one knew where the father had been. Save the Children actually worked with our local partners and with our partners in the United States to reunify this little girl with her mom, Angelina. But that kind of policy and practice, I've worked for Save the Children for 21 years. I have met tons of separated children and families, and usually that's because a family is fleeing from war or a natural disaster, and our job is to actually put those families back together. I have never seen a government separate children and their families like we are doing in the United States and have done. So again, from a child perspective, I think we just have a long, long way to go to make sure that these kids are protected.
Powerful. Thank you, Carolyn. Jonathan.
Thank you. And thanks to the Global Philanthropy Forum for having this important discussion, for inviting us. I've been an immigration lawyer working in South Texas in the detention centers for all my career, about 15 years. And to kind of begin my remarks, or to put a banner over, I think, my remarks, I've spoken with young men from Somalia in their 20s and 30s 10 years ago, who have fled unbelievable violence, who have seen their mothers and sisters raped and shot dead in front of them, who have fled Al-Shabaab and other ills. I've spoken with 8-year-old girls from Central America who have fled abusive parents, danger in their community, still bear the scars of cigar burns that they would get from their drunken father. And what is remarkable to me over the history of that time that I've done this work is the consistency of the expressions that these folks talk to me about when I meet them in detention. Never mind the fact that they have fled violence that I could not even conceive of. when I speak with them about the scariest day in their life, the worst thing that ever happened to them, with all striking and shocking consistency. Across the board, folks describe their arrival at the United States border as the scariest, most terrifying experience of their lives. They do suffer violence. We are violent with refugees and immigrants, women and children, when they come to our border. But it obviously pales in comparison to the violence that they fled. And so I wonder, why do they describe this as the most horrible day? And it is because they arrived to the United States with that image in their minds that we, for the past 70 plus years at least, have built up around the world of being the beacon of freedom and democracy, a shining light for the entire world to see. And it isn't the physical pain or the deprivation at the border that really causes this trauma to these people. It is the destruction of that image of the United States that they had in their hearts and in their minds that really brought them, that guided them on this flight from terror and this journey towards freedom. And that all comes crashing down when they arrive at the U.S. border. A little bit of process, because I think that there's a lot of misconceptions as to what does happen and to whom at the border. The U.S. Border Patrol are charged with the apprehension of individuals who either request asylum at the border or who are apprehended after having crossed into the border. Right now, there's being described a crisis at the border, but I think Lee will get into detail. I think we should be very careful with the employment of this term crisis, because many times we actually play into the narrative that we seek to counter when we accept the premise of these terms. There is a crisis at the border, but it is not our crisis. It is the crisis of these people who are fleeing violence and seeking protection. Our response to it is making that crisis worse. And as the most powerful, richest, quote-unquote, greatest nation on Earth and the history of Earth, I think it is demeaning to the capabilities of our country when we say that this is a crisis to us, that we are beyond our capacity. I find it interesting that it's often individuals who proclaim great patriotism who are the vessels of this narrative, which actually undermines and lowers expectation as to what we as a country can do. But what happens when individuals are either hand themselves over, whether they hand themselves over at a port of entry or they're apprehended after crossing the river or the desert, they are brought by Border Patrol into what's called the or the icebox. And this could be a Border Patrol station. Often you see that in the pictures released by DHS. Or it could be, by reports, again, consistent across culture, across age, across language, across time, appear to be mobile containers that are littered around the southern part of Texas, where people are brought. These metal boxes could be refrigerated to as low as 55 degrees Fahrenheit, which is cold in and of itself, but if you imagine that a person who's been walking through the desert in 115 degree temperature, who's sweaty, who's bloody, who might still be wet from crossing the river, to be thrown into that environment is nothing short of torture. Individuals are purported to stay there for 2 to 3 days. We have reports of people staying there more than 1 month. The treatment that they receive is very rough. The words that they are told by the Border Patrol are "Welcome to hell." If you think that what you're leaving is bad, wait till what we have in store for you. If you apply for asylum, then we will keep you in here forever. This is the greeting that people receive when they're coming to the United States. This is our new Statue of Liberty, if you will. Our new Ellis Island is a detention center. Folks are brought into these hileras, and this is where the sorting of people begins. They separate families immediately. Fathers and sons are often brought to different hileras. Children and women are kept in the same boxes. You have reports of women who are pregnant lying on a concrete floor alongside children who are carrying the varicella virus. And of course, a woman who is pregnant who is exposed to that could lose her baby, could cause lifelong mental health damage to that child. From there, children are brought into what are called shelters, but are actually detention centers. They're called shelters because they're run by nonprofits, but they're detention centers because the reason that they exist is to keep the children there so that if ICE wants to take them and deport them back to the hell from whence they fled, that those so-called shelters are there to keep those children ready for ICE to come and take them. The adults are sent to for-profit prisons. We have a massive prison industrial complex that is growing in the United States, despite what we hear with regard to the criminal justice system. Immigration is the diversification strategy for these multinational for-profit prison companies that see immigration as the new boom industry. They could be taken as a single adult to a prison or what they call a family unit, which in itself is not true because the only people kept in so-called family detention centers are single parents with their children. The married couples are separated. If a father and a mother and the child arrive to the border, the father will be sent to an adult detention center. The child and the mother may be sent to a family detention center. The conditions inside of all of these facilities are abhorrent. And the treatment of the individuals who are in them, be they children or adults, vulnerable, is nothing less than sick. The medical conditions are subpar. The number one and number two prescribed medicines for any ill, be it a headache or a broken bone, is aspirin or water. We have seen water prescribed for a broken bone in medical records coming out of the Carnes Detention Center. While people are in these detention centers, they must go through multiple hurdles of interviews to be able to prove that they have a claim to ask for asylum here in the United States. We spoke this summer with parents who, within 2 hours of being separated from their children, were thrust into an office with an immigration officer and forced to explain the worst things in the world that ever happened to them. In the family detention centers, we see mothers brought with their children into these interviews and forced to describe rape, forced to describe assault, sometimes by their own husbands, the father of the child who's sitting there, and it's the first time that the child has ever heard this information. But we focus very much on the detention center, but the legal case is actually a very long road. Most people who get out from detention have yet to actually appear at court for their final hearing. And so something I'd like to talk about a little bit longer in our discussion is the long road of help. As even though we are focused on the detention and the border issues, which is important, there is much, much more heavy lifting and much for philanthropy to do in the long road of actually following people and walking with them through the long immigration case that's before them.
Jonathan, thank you. Powerful. We'll have a chance to come back, particularly on the whole trauma and psychosocial needs of children. But Lee.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. So I agree with what Carolyn said. The root causes, we need to get into those countries and get at the root causes. Unfortunately, this administration doesn't look like they're doing that, and it's not going to be a short-term solution. So in the meantime, we need to deal over here, and what the ACLU does principally is litigation. We have now filed 85 immigration cases against the Trump administration just from the National ACLU. That's excluding our 50 state affiliates and excluding all the immigration cases against states and localities that are now passing anti-immigrant measures because they've been emboldened by this administration. And that's obviously a lot, and we are drowning, and I think if we had more resources, we'd be filing twice as many. It just gives you a sense of what this administration is doing, and I think it's even wearing down the career lawyers at the Justice Department. I'm seeing them all over the country, and the last time I saw them, they looked like they were dragging, and I said, well, your boss doesn't have to enact so many of these anti-immigrant policies, and he, of course, said, well, the ACLU doesn't have to actually sue about all of them. The thing about it is that these are major changes to our immigration system. They're not sort of tinkering around the edges. I mean, the travel ban, we sued over the asylum ban, now they're returning people to dangerous places in Mexico to wait for their asylum, separation of families. And these are all suits, just some of the suits that we've had to bring. And I think what differentiates, I've been at the ACLU for more than 26 years doing this work, and what differentiates the time now, I think, is that this administration is sort of breaking all the unwritten rules.
right? It used to be that both Democratic and Republican administrations sort of had an unwritten rule, we're not going to go to schools or courthouses to look for people who are out of status. I mean, everyone knows, everybody in prior administrations, Democratic or Republican, knows if you stood outside an urban school area, you could find parents that were out of status. But you just didn't do it because the cost to the family, the cost to the child not attending schools, and family separation is the same thing. I was picking up on something that Carolyn said. I mean, this is the worst thing. Family separation is the worst thing I have seen in my 26 plus years at the ACLU, both because it's gratuitous and in its cruelty. I mean, it's gratuitous, you know, for all the reasons that my prior colleagues have said. When I talk to the families who are separated, when they get their children back, I always ask them, would you have come anyway if you had known your child was going to be taken away? And they just shrug and throw up their hands and say, what choice did I have? If I had stayed, my child might have been killed, I might have been killed. So it was never going to work, and that's something that prior administrations, again, Democratic and Republican, understood, right? I mean, one of the big turning points in the public relations battle was when Laura Bush came out and wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post and said, look, in America, we just don't do this. And what we now know is that the administration separated 2,800 families, including little babies. That's what was reported to the court and reported to us as the lawyers in the case. We have now been able to reunite almost all of them, or give them an opportunity to reunite. Some have chosen to leave their children in the U.S. because it's just too dangerous to bring them back. Unfortunately, what I think a lot of the general public doesn't know is that a recent report has revealed that there may have been thousands more separated who were never reported to us or the court. So we recently went back to court and said the government needs to account for these thousands more. The government argued it was going to be too much of a burden to go through all the files because they had no tracking system for the families. And the court said, look, in a civilized society, we just don't forget about little children. And so now this is going to take hold, and we may be looking at another 2,000 families we need to reunite. But, you know, it's beyond the numbers, obviously, right? It's the little acts of cruelty, and Jonathan mentioned some of it. You know, a four-year-old boy who needed glasses, his family was very modest means. They were able to get him glasses, fortunately, and they also got him a glasses case, and the glasses case became like a pivotal part of their life, because if he broke his glasses, he was never going to be able to get another pair. When they came to take him away, he fortunately had his glasses on, but he couldn't get his glasses case. So all day long, all the mother does is worry, can her little boy see? If they break, are they going to get him a new pair of glasses? You know, an 18-month-old baby, another one of our clients, that the mother was told she has to put the baby in the car seat and strap him in. He was crying, but she couldn't comfort him. She had to close the door. And the little baby, as everyone knows who, you know, has a little kid, you put him in the car seat, they're conditioned to turn their head and wait for the parent to walk around to the driver's seat to get in to drive the car, while the baby is looking and looking, and the car just pulls away with his mother standing there. It's just one story after another. A father of a seven-year-old, who was one of our other clients, begged to be able to tell his child, just the simplest little thing, can I be the one who tells my child they're going to take him away, right? I mean, every parent has experienced that. If something is going to be traumatizing to the child, you want to be able to first explain that you don't want the child to be. They wouldn't even do that. They had to say out loud in front of the child before the father could talk to the child, we're going to take you away and send you away. This is one story after another. And, you know, I know that I was supposed to talk about the larger policy. The reason I'm talking about it is because I think for us, and for, you know, I think what civil rights lawyers have always known is, there's a limit to what you can do just by abstract legal arguments, unless, and this goes to the other point, unless you can get people to feel the humanity of the client, you're not going to change things. And I think to the extent there's a silver lining in family separation is that with the help of everyone on the stage, we were able to tell those human stories and the public pushed back. I mean, not everyone agrees with the ACLU about macro immigration policy, but we were able to cross that line between Democratic, Republican, Republican, conservative, liberal, and people like Laura Bush, the Pope, conservative reverends, pushed back and said, look, there are some lines we just don't cross. And in fact, the president issued an executive order that had a million holes in it. But still, it was the only time on a domestic policy he has changed his mind. And it was because of the public outcry, because we were able to create a human dimension to it. And so for me, and I hope we'll talk a little about this, that's going to be, I think, there's going to be these larger policy issues and legal cases, but ultimately we're going to have to be able to tell these human stories, just as Jonathan was doing, about who are these families and what actually is happening to them.
Great. Lee, thank you. And thank all of you. That was so powerful. Well, let's get the conversation going now. I'm going to kick it off with some questions, and then, but I would encourage our panelists, if they want to get into a conversation with each other, please do, and I'll do my best to moderate. The first question that I want to start with is really to take us back to the crisis on the southern border. We've all noticed there's a big upsurge in the numbers in the last several months. Shelters or detention centers, as Jonathan said, government service, nonprofits, everyone is reporting being overwhelmed. There was a 31% increase in the number of people intercepted in February compared to January, and by some accounts, or maybe up to 100,000 people in March. And so help us, and Carolyn, let's start with you, but everyone jump in. Help us understand why the upsurge right now, and just if you could briefly kind of describe and sum up the humanitarian crisis as you see it on the ground.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it stems from those issues that are happening in these countries. And as Maria said, the vast majority of the families that are coming from the Northern Triangle. There was a study actually that UNHCR did, now it's probably about a year old, and they interviewed thousands of children who were on the journey actually through Mexico, and about 48% of them said yes, they had experienced violence already in their home countries. And that those that said they, those the other, you know, 42% or 52% said they were afraid that they were going to experience that violence. So, again, that trauma that kids are facing is what, in a lot of cases, is making families make the journey. I think the. And I think it was Lee that said, you know, if you ask these families, would you do this again, even though you've gone through this horrible experience, almost all the families that I've talked to said, I would do it again, because it was the choice of whether my child actually had any future at all, or if maybe they had some chance of surviving and getting an education and actually, you know, coming to school, so and being in a place that where they were safe. So, and one of the things you're seeing now is with that those huge numbers is that there are an estimated 50,000 unaccompanied children now in Mexico. So on the other side of the border.
Right.
And those children are also at great risk. There's lots of evidence that a lot of those kids, especially girls, have undergone, you know, have had sexual violence on the trip there. So organizations are really working on both sides of the border on this protection issue. And when kids come, when they finally do get over the border, I think one of the most important things to focus on is the psychosocial issue. And Maria, I know you'll talk about it a little bit in your school, and this idea of trauma and the psychological first aid that's needed for these children is, again, really, really real. And I think that's one of the areas we need to focus on as a community in an even bigger way for these kids.
Great. Jonathan.
I think it's very interesting to build on that. I'd love to hear actually what you have to say about it, because when we talk about addressing the root causes, yeah. There is a presumption that those root causes are uniquely and solely in the Northern Triangle, right. And that it is our job as the better angel to go and to have them solve their problems that they've got over there. And I think what we fail to discuss in this context is, one, the close relationship between what are currently seen as mostly narcotic criminal syndicates and those paramilitary groups and military groups that survived from the Central American civil wars of the 1980s and 90s and the close relationship between those, but also that the root causes, I think that there might be a reluctance, I wonder, sometimes to really chase those root causes, because you may go to Central America only to then have to come back to the United States to find them. You know, these gangs, if you will, gangs, and I think it's ironic, I'm an Irish citizen originally, I don't have the cool accent, but, you know, the IRA, known as a paramilitary terrorist political organization, was also the largest narco-trafficking organization in Ireland. But they weren't called a narco-trafficking organization. And so it's just the lens that you look through to describe, and who gets to describe what these groups are.
Well, and that trafficking, most of that trafficking is to get drugs to the United States.
Well, this is the point. These groups are dealing in more money than the GNP of those three nations combined. And yes, they work lock, stock, and smoking barrel for us. These MS-13 folks, their job is to deliver cheap drugs and cheap sex to the American consumer. And so I think before we really kind of patronizingly start to talk about root causes, we need to look in a mirror and really realize what our role in this is.
Yeah. Mm. The one thing I would just add, not to take anything away from these, but I think we also, and I think probably my panelists would agree, is to be careful throwing around the word crisis, because you now, it's seeping into mainstream media and you hear everyone talking about it, and to be careful about what exactly is the crisis. There's no question that there are large humanitarian needs, but that's very different than saying the United States government can't handle the flow of migrants now, and that they need to take these extreme measures, which are antithetic to our values, and we believe inconsistent with the laws Congress has written in the Constitution, right? I mean, just to give some examples, when we went in for the asylum ban, one of the government's arguments was there's so many people flooding across the border, and this was before the recent surge. But even with the recent surge, you know, we're anticipating 650,000 to 900,000 if you really project out, and that's an extreme. Well, in 2000, there were 1.6 million people coming, right? Far bigger. And the budget now for CBP is $19 billion. It dwarfs the budget, well over twice the amount of the budget in 2000, maybe three times. There are now well more than 19,000 agents. There used to be in 2006, when the numbers were higher, only 7,000 agents. And so, you know, it just sort of reminds me of the family separation issue. One of the things that everyone says, well, how is the United States government going to handle getting all these kids back together? Well, they certainly had the resources to take them away. And then they actually in court had the audacity to say, HHS doesn't have a budget line for reunifications. We may have to ask the parents to pay for the travel back. And my point is simply that when the United States government wants to do something, if this administration wanted to make something a priority, they have the resources to do it, and the agencies already have the resources. There is no question they could move resources around to process asylum seekers. They're just not doing it, and so then you see this crisis build up, and then the mainstream media starts talking about it, a crisis. I think we just all need to be very careful, because that's ultimately going to be the justification for more and more policies that are extreme and are not going to be helpful.
We've been hearing from civil society leaders shedding light on the realities that migrants and asylum seekers face. After the break, join us for the second half of the conversation, which is moderated by Mercy Corps' leader, Neil Kenny-Geyer. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council, produced in association with KQED and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Lee Gallant, Deputy Director of ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project, Carolyn Miles, President and CEO of Save the Children, Maria Moreno, Principal of Las Americas Newcomer School in Texas, and Jonathan Ryan, CEO and President of RAISES. Moderating the program is Neil Kenny-Geyer. He's CEO of Mercy Corps. To hear this or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program.
Maria, I want to come back again to some of the trauma and psychosocial needs of children, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. however we describe it, we know there are an awful lot of kids who are paying a price for this, and it's impacting them developmentally, socially, in every other way. What are you seeing at your school? Because this is a specialty of
yours. It is a specialty,
yeah.
Yes. So in going back to Carolyn's point, we just enrolled 50 students in the past 3 weeks. And so and one of my little girls who just came in, she's a 12-year-old student who is pregnant now, because she was raped along her journey coming here. And when mom told me the situation, I mean, totally wraparound services and making sure that she was going to get.
How old did you say she was?
She was almost 13. She's 12 and a little bit more. So. So she, and so you're looking at a 12-year-old who, 13 practically, who really doesn't know what's, I mean, she's a child herself, and she really doesn't understand what really happened, and she's traumatized. But the first thing that we have to do, and again, we specialize in trauma on our campus, is we have to make this welcoming environment for our kids and our families. And so the first thing you do is you're going to see a smile on their, on my every my secretary, my person who does all the enrollment has a smile on their face, and it doesn't matter if they're having a bad day at home, my own employees, right? But they are there to welcome all kids, all families. If they don't know, if they're illiterate themselves, we fill out the paperwork for them because we want them to feel welcome. If they don't have the paperwork, we'll venture out and find these paperwork so that they have everything that they need, and we're not sending kids away yet again. So we don't even have a time limit. We'll enroll kids at 8 o'clock at night if I have to. I'll open up the school 7 days a week if I need to. But what I do is I make sure that our kids are welcomed and our families are welcomed. It's important to build these consistency, these routines. We want to get our kids back to normal, whatever normalcy is for them, because it's important for them to, again, know that they are embraced and they're welcomed by all of my faculty members. All my teachers are specially trained in trauma. We do cultural sensitivity. We do lots of trauma sensitivity as well to make sure that our kids, a lot of them have PTSD, ADHD, ADD. And so instead of teachers saying, you know, you're acting out, you're fidgeting, you're doing, you know, get out of my room. We don't do that. We don't suspend. We don't. We have lots of wraparound specialists on our campus to make sure that we really embrace and provide the tools that they need in their classrooms. So if they're fidgeting, we give them fidget items. If they are moving around, we have bands around the chair so they can put their legs there and kick, you know, so that they can feel a sense of, I mean, they're just kind of anxious students. A lot of social, thanks to Save the Children, we do have, we have 9 social workers on our campus to help with the social emotional needs. We do group therapy, family therapy, individual therapy. We do lots of case management so that our students can then be able to then open up and really help us understand the needs. We work with lots of different partnerships as far as hospitals. So if they need a psychiatrist, if they need a psychologist, if we have a student who came through is from El Salvador, and dad had told him to that they were going to go into this small area where he couldn't go to the bathroom, right? And so he told the little boy, from now on, you know, we're not going to eat or drink anything because it's going to be a couple of days before we can get out of this container, if you will. And when we enrolled the child, it was interesting because he was vomiting a lot in school, and he was always crying, and he would always, you know, grab hold his stomach area. And I thought maybe it's just he was nervous. You know, he hadn't been in school. He hadn't been in school in 3 years. And so we said, okay, let him go home. And we kind of even did this come to school for a couple of hours and then go home, you know, that kind of transition. And that wasn't working. We took him to the hospital. We have lots of relationships with other hospital medical professionals. And come to find out, he had a gastrointestinal situation that actually he had to be hospitalized for at least a month so that he can get some help, because he was severely constipated is what happened. And so, and he was in severe pain. I remember he would hold me and he would say, you know, it hurts, it hurts, it hurts. And so I knew there was something wrong with this child. Those are just stories. I mean, every single child, I have 345 students right now, and I can tell you I have 345 stories to share about some of the things. We provide clothing for our entire family, right? So not only for our children, but for the entire family. So if they're looking for a job, they can go in there and find a suit. If they have a newborn, you know how quickly you grow out through, you know, you grow out of that. So we really provide at least that support for the families. We actually work with a lot of the universities so that we can leverage more mental health and more social workers on our campus. So if you need, you know, if you're working on your master's and you need internship hours or something, we leverage that. And then we also are helping our future nursing through the Baylor College of Medicine. And so we leverage them so that they can work with our refugee immigrant population so that they know their social emotional needs as well as they're working with our kids. And so we really try and embrace our kids as much as possible to ensure that and that they are ready. I only have a year. My kids stay in on my campus for a year, and it's my job to help them, support them, embrace them, and support so that they can move on to a comprehensive middle or high school program where they then can have the voice. I try to empower them so that they know how to have those discussions with their counselors or whatnot.
Jonathan and Carolyn, maybe if you guys briefly could address maybe perhaps what you're seeing, some of the special needs of kids who've been separated from their families and then end up in some of your programs as well. I know, Lee, you described that so wonderfully for all. Wonderfully is the wrong word, but in a powerful way that moved our hearts. But yep. Carolyn and then Jonathan?
Yeah, so maybe just briefly, there's a Save the Children program called Journey of Hope, which we actually developed after natural disasters for kids that had gone through trauma of a natural disaster, and we now do that program everywhere around the world. And it really is about at Maria School. It's actually a training for caregivers, so it's not just for sometimes children are enrolled, particularly older children, but it's really a program for caregivers. So we're doing that program across the border on the U.S. side, so that you have caregivers that are prepared for the kinds of things that Maria described and how they can help those kids get back to a normal situation. And I have to say that school is the number one thing. that you can do for children who have gone through trauma. Getting kids back into a normal routine and going to school with other children and feeling like, okay, there is something normal here about my life. That is probably the most important thing that you can possibly do. So a lot of our work in the U.S. for these kids is around training caregivers, making sure that kids can get into school even while they wait to go to another school or while they're waiting to get to other family members. Just getting that normal routine reestablished, super important.
Great. Thanks, Carolyn. Jonathan.
I think as a baseline, be they children who were separated, children who were unaccompanied, children who were held in detention with their parents, I think services must be trauma-informed. They must be culturally appropriate. I think one of the biggest risks that we have with the arrival of Central American refugees to the United States is that they are, both in the detention and the legal system, as well as we see now in the school system, misidentified as Spanish-speaking children, because they know a few words of Spanish and the teacher knows a few words of Spanish. Mm-hmm. But we are seeing more and more in the 10 years that I've been working specifically with unaccompanied children, we have seen a reversal. Guatemala used to be a distant third in the country representation of children and refugees. It is now a strong first. And many of the people are from those indigenous areas of the country speaking non-Spanish languages, and they're getting misidentified in the school as Spanish speakers, and they don't understand anything that's happening. It's pushing them back and back. As well as the trauma-informed, they need access to counseling. And it needs to meet their needs when they are ready for it. I think any kind of a system that addresses the needs of these children must be flexible, and it must be child-centered. It must be client-centered. I don't think that setting up a process and then grinding people through it is going to work. In fact, it just starts to resemble the exact system that they have just been ground through. Mm-hmm. Particular to the separated families. And it's the kind of other side of the coin of family detention, quite honestly, is that this is a direct attack at one of the most, if not the most important relationship that a human being will ever have in her life, which is the relationship with the mother or father or parent. And it occurs during some of the most crucial times of child development. Be they kept with their parent in a detention center where essentially there is a flattening of that parent-child relationship. They are all just subjects to the guards, which is very demeaning to the parent and erosive of that parent-child relationship, or in the family separation context, because I know and you know who to be angry at because of separation. That child doesn't know who to be angry at other than their parent. And so you see relationships that have been destroyed through this process that I think we as a society have a responsibility to help repair and rebuild.
Great. Right. I was going to just say one quick thing about that. I mean, I agree with that completely. I mean, I just recently testified in Congress about family separation. There was a doctor there who described what the children are going through and that it's really actually changing their brain. That think about for an adult the 15 minutes in your life when you were most anxious and scared. Those 15 minutes, amplify that and then think of it going on for 6 months, you being in that state for 6 months. And that's what it was like for these children. And I just want to reiterate, because I think it's so important what Jonathan just said, the children need so much help, trauma-centered help, but the parents also need enormous help. But I just don't want us to forget about that. I mean, the parents are often very young to begin with, and their relationship, I mean, the children, one after another, were literally 4 and 5 year old, 3 year old, being pulled away and screaming, "Mommy, please don't let them take me away." And the parents were just standing there helplessly, sometimes in handcuffs, watching. And as Jonathan said, the children are too young to understand that it wasn't the parents' fault. The parent could not help. So the parent is just saying to them, "Be brave, be brave." And the children are coming back when we're reuniting them and saying, "Didn't you love me enough to stop it? Or why did you let them take me away?" And that guilt is weighing on these parents to beyond what you could possibly comprehend. And I think when we are trying to get services to these families, we really need to make sure that the parents are getting services as well.
Great point. So I want to turn now, if I can, to just the broader conversation regarding immigration. I know we have just about 8 minutes left. So Are there any silver linings anywhere that you're seeing? Are there any effective strategies that any of you have seen for bridging the politics, the bitter partisan divides that we see, for creating more empathy, for meeting the real needs of families and children and upholding their rights? And Lee, I'm going to first start with you on that, because I'd like you also to tell us how the cases are proceeding.
Yeah.
And I know there are a lot of people in this room and watching who want to help, and maybe tell us how we can.
Yeah, so that's the big question, I guess. From my standpoint, I feel like the courts have given me hope. I don't know ultimately how all our cases are going to turn out. The travel ban was a partial success in that we were able to push back, made them change it three times, narrow it, and it took a long time for it to go into effect. Ultimately lost that case in the Supreme Court. Family separation, we've managed to win and keep the government so far from appealing it. The asylum ban, we got a national injunction. The government is appealing it. We'll see ultimately what happens. But we've had a lot of success in the courts, and I think that's important for people to think about, that in some ways the system is working, that the courts, seeing the legislature and the executive branch not stepping in or being the cause of the problem, have stepped up. So I think that's been heartening. But ultimately, what I come back to is that there's going to need to be public outcry. I think, you know, this is the first time, the closest I've seen in my 25 years plus at the ACLU, of a sort of a real civil rights moment around family separation. You know, not rising to the level of what we saw in the 60s, but I think any civil rights litigator will tell you that real lasting systemic change can only occur if there's lawyers in court, but there's the public pushing back. And I think that was the silver lining for family separation, is that we were able to cross that divide by getting the human stories out. And ultimately, I think that's the only way. I think we lose when we talk about abstractions and the rule of law. I can go on TV or public spaces and talk the rule of law and the Constitution, but ultimately, to cut through the noise, you're going to have people see these families, see what they're going through, and decide, okay, well, there's a lot of things I disagree with about larger immigration policy, but ultimately I don't want to see these children in detention or taken away from their parents, or I want to see a fair process for people applying for asylum. So they really need to know, as Carolyn said, that there are real dangers out there and they're fleeing. And so to rebut the narrative, and that's ultimately what I see my job as having to do, is sort of rebut the narrative. When the president says, sure, apply for asylum, just go to a port of entry and do it legally, that's an intuitively appealing soundbite for a lot of people. And they say, yeah, what's wrong with that? But it's our job to get the narrative out that sometimes the ports of entry can be 1,000 miles apart, and you're not going to walk with a four-year-old those 1,000 miles, or a smuggler brings you between the ports of entry. And it's also our job to get the narrative out that at the ports of entry, the government is letting the lines just pile up. I just came back from Tijuana, and the families and little children are in the most dangerous, squalid conditions, and the administration's processing only a handful of claims each day instead of sending asylum officers there to process the claims. So ultimately, I think us rebutting the facts and getting the narrative out in a human way, and we're going to continue turning to the courts, because the courts, I feel, have been a savior, but that can't be the only.
Mm. Thank you.
Silver lining for me is, after doing this for 15 years, I no longer have to take 15 or 20 minutes to explain to people what I do. But I think that speaks to what Lee was referring to, that this was, the silver lining is that there was a massive uprising against this policy. And it's the first time in my career that I have seen so many people across the country vocalize an expression of rejection of an immigration policy based on fundamentally human reasons. You don't have to know immigration law, you don't have to be an international human rights attorney to understand that what happened was wrong. And I guess it took them going that extra mile in terms of wrong to wake people up. I think that there is tremendous amount of things that people can do all across the country. People should understand, I think one reason that the groups like Raices have been able to respond to this is that these are not new things. These are all tactics and practices and instruments that have been in place for many years and under many presidencies. If anything, it was a little harder to organize against them under the previous administration because you were fighting disbelief that this was going on. Now it's all too easy to explain to people that this is going on. But, you know, what was kind of policies and practices that were on the border and in detention centers along the border were kind of like an art house cinema version. And what this administration is doing is they are bringing it to a cinema near you. And so what you are seeing happening along the border is happening in your community. There are families being separated in your hometown. Most people are detained actually in jails. Immigration's budget pays not just for immigration detention centers, but for beds in local city and county jails. It is happening in your backyard. And I think that this is an opportunity for people to take a new look at their own communities, at the apparatus that is controlling and hovering over these people, and to take local action. So it's not just going to the border. We need that help. But this is happening in your town.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Carolyn.
So I would point to two things. One is, so we had an experience. We have a network of 300,000 advocates across the United States through something called the Save the Children Action Network. And they typically don't, this is not an issue that we had mobilized people around until we got to a point where you had family separation and then you had tear gassing of mothers and children at the border. And we said, we can't stand by and kind of watch this without activating our advocates. So we did that, and it resulted in 170,000 messages to Congress, right? And put that in a very, and those were their members of Congress, so we have something set up online which allows you very easily to send a letter to your congressperson and tell them your opinion about what's happening. And that was actually the most successful mobilization of that group that we've ever had. So it gives me hope that people out there really do care about this issue and they care enough to actually get involved politically. The second thing I would point to is that it goes back to my first comment about the other. And I actually believe that the generation of young people now, I think we're calling them Gen Z, you know, that is a generation that doesn't think about people as the other. They really don't think about things in that way. And so my hope is that by engaging and mobilizing more young people in the United States on these issues, we can also start to change the tide. So two positives.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. Maria, and we're all going to remember the rhinos.
We're going to remember the rhinos. So, and just to kind of close, because I've been at the school for 14 years now, I kind of see, you know, kids coming back and visiting. And I have a former student of mine who's now a psychiatrist in the Dallas-Fort Worth area who came to this country as an undocumented person. And now here she is as you know, Dr. Hernandez. And I have a student that I was tweeting one day about the school, and he replies back and he says, I love this school. This is why I learned English. This was the best years of my life. And so I responded to him and I said, you need to come visit me. So he came to visit me, and he is a junior at the University of Houston. He is studying to be a teacher, a math teacher in the middle school level. And so I told him, I said, Juan, I am so proud of you. I remember when you were, you know, you were here and you didn't know anything, you know, any English. And so here you are now, a junior, and have overcome all these adversities that you, that you've undergone. And so I told him, I said, honey, you will have a job. You have a job at my school. You need to graduate, and I would love to hire my first alumni. And he turns around and looks at me and he says, Miss Moreno, I can't wait for the interview. And I said, no, honey, you have the job.
What a great way to end. Join me in thanking.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Lee Gallant. He's deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project. Carolyn Miles, president and CEO of Save the Children. Maria Moreno, principal of the Las Americas Newcomer School. And Jonathan Ryan, CEO and president of Raices. The program was moderated by Neil Kenny-Geyer, CEO of Mercy Corps. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producer is Jared Sport. And our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.